Welcome back to the Rob O'Donnell Show on WILK News Radio, 103.1 FM, 910, 980 AM, or anywhere in the nation on that free Odyssey app. It is 410, 78 degrees on this Wednesday, June 18th, 2025. And it's always great to bring in our experts and our friend of the show. And we have Robert Pizzini, Navy EOD expert. Technician, retired, best-selling author of Elevate Your Leadership, and owner of I Fly Virginia Beach. And we'll talk about all those in a minute. But he was also the officer in charge of the Nuclear Response Navy EOD team. So, Robert, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thanks, Rob. Always good to be on the show.
So, you know, we were talking earlier, and what we're talking about here is this 15-ton, it's known as the GBU-57AB Massive Ordnance Penetrator. It's this bunker buster bomb that they've been talking about that possibly the U.S. could use to take out Iran's deep nuclear facility that's buried in a mountainside. And I was asking the questions of the pros and cons of this. If we do use this type of weapon and it implodes that entire area, what type of fallout is there? You know, can other terrorist groups down the road years later go in there and of course, hazardous to themselves, but get nuclear material or radioactive material that they could use later for a dirty bomb or some kind of nefarious reasons? Or is it better to not go this route and maybe try to negotiate, get inspectors in there to disable, dismantle this system and remove it altogether, which is what what was originally on the table from the Trump administration?
Yeah, well, your second option is definitely the better option. Avoiding spread and release of contamination, although it would be very limited because we're talking about centrifuges that are processing uranium versus a reactor, which is taking processed uranium, exposing it to neutrons and creating heat or fission or fusion, you know, the nuclear cycle, the criticality cycle. So that's not, you know, that's not what exists at Fordow in particular. But what does exist is a lot of uranium that they're in the process of enriching. And uranium by itself in these various stages of enrichment, in combination with the fact that this is so deep underground and it's surrounded by mountain and rock, there wouldn't be a radioactive cloud per se, and this downwind contamination, like we saw with Chernobyl, for example. But again, to your point, a tactical ground operation, a raid of some sort, or better yet, getting an Iranian faction to take control and capitulate would definitely be the best option.
Now, you've trained in your career for this type of response. You've trained for these types of weapons. This GBU-57AB Massive Ordnance Penetrator, I mean, they're saying it's 15-ton bunker buster. Is this the largest in our arsenal that's public to the known to the public at this time?
Yeah, it's similar in size. So it's 10,000 pounds of high explosive, which is similar to the Moab, the mother of all bombs that was dropped in Afghanistan during the first Trump administration. But this one, it's called a bunker buster for a different reason. There's a slight delay element. There's a couple different configurations, but I believe on the 57, there's a slight delay element for a first detonation, or there's a first detonation, excuse me, there's a slight delay element to allow the mass to penetrate to a certain extent, to penetrate the rock. Then there's a first detonation, and then, you know, microseconds later, there's a second detonation. So the first detonation creating greater access for the second detonation to reach deeper into the target, the bunker in this case.
Now, have you had a chance to look at the aerial satellite photos of this area, the mountainside, the bunker? It looked like there were several entrances, several buildings built into the side of this mountain. You know, what kind of repeated attack would this take on our part to make sure that it's disabled totally?
Yeah, well, you know, that depends on the desired end state, President Trump's desired end state. Is he looking for the government to change its behavior permanently, or is he looking to, you know, totally destroy a refining capability, a nuclear capability, you know? And I think the desired end state is, Trump has even said that, surrender. We're not looking for peace talks or, ceasefire. We're looking for total surrender. So what best achieves that? What best will achieve that? Destroying that facility in total, which there's other ways to attack that facility that aren't being discussed as well. You could take out all the access points to that facility, and basically you're denying access to anybody to get to it. You could do area denial through landmine and aerial dropped explosive mines, essentially, to deny access for a period of time to that facility. But then that does create something, a hazard for people who would access it down the road, assuming the Iranian government capitulated. Then that becomes an EOD problem to gain access. So there's a few different ways to deal with this other than just destroying this facility outright.
And as far as the residual that would be left if it is attacked, if it's not an inspection, dismantlement type thing, could it be used down the road by any entity for nefarious reasons, whatever's left there? I know you said it was different stages of reactors, but we've seen back where, bad actors have dug up, nuclear waste and have used it to possibly try to get dirty bombs or such like that. Could this be used in that manner as well?
So in theory, it could. It would take, two things. One is people who don't know what they're doing would probably injure themselves trying to acquire, they would expose themselves to certain levels of radiation. And if they don't have proper protection, if they don't understand a little bit of science behind what radiological isotopes do, they'd probably hurt themselves. So you do need people with training to come in and number one, acquire or capture, and number two, to turn it into something of enough volume to create what's essentially called a radiological dispersal device, an RDD, which just denies area for people. If a radiological dispersal device goes off anywhere, then that landmass is denied until that problem is cleaned up or dealt with in some capacity. So the risk of that is a factor, but I think that is a low risk component, especially if there was mass devastation, because then some element, I think, would have to go into that site at some point if it's destroyed. An element of the Israeli army or some other force would have to further assess the site and ensure that the scenario you just painted is also eliminated.
All right, so there would be follow-up on-the-ground activities there to make sure that it could never be nefariously used, cordoned off, or whatever need be there.
Yeah, I think there would have to be, for sure.
As far as what we're seeing now with the Israeli attacks on the perimeter, the peripheral nuclear facilities that aren't there deep embedded, and basically the total collapse of the Iranian air defense system, they did have a pretty robust air force that we haven't seen anything from. It appears that there's free reign over the airspace of Iran, where you've seen Israel just use tactical, like going through windows or going through the side of doors, blowing out bedrooms type strikes, to where Iran is just indiscriminately lobbing either surface-to-surface ballistic missiles, surface-to-air ballistic missiles, or drones. Where do you think Iran stands as far as their capability to do much of anything at this point, rather than just lob indiscriminately?
Yeah, so I think they were degraded 9 months, I can't remember, maybe 9 months ago or so, when the last exchange between Israel and Iran took place. So their air defenses were degraded significantly back then. Around the same time, Hezbollah, the Beeper attacks on Hezbollah, and some of the other activities that the Israelis were doing. And what they were doing is, in this real precise but very long-term way, they were breaking down the Iranian offensive and defensive mechanism. So I wouldn't call Iran a sitting duck at this point, but I would say that they're gasping as a military capability. They are on their last breaths, and they have no teeth And they really haven't throughout this entire exchange to do anything significant. And you know, as we've seen, every time they rearm a launcher, they lose, or you know, all their launchers, they lose half of them because the Israeli intelligence system picks up the location of these launchers and takes them out. The other thing they're doing is hitting the storage sites for the missiles that ultimately go on these launchers. So they're again, their offensive capability, their defensive, they have no defensive capability, or so little that it's insignificant at this point. And then their offensive capability has probably got days left in being able to launch a single missile.
Now, are you getting any feedback from members of your former community in naval, you know, the Navy EOD or anything of that matter? You see a lot in the media likening this to the weapons of mass destruction back in Iraq, where, you know, that there was nothing there. This was all a lot of hyperbole. Is the intelligence you're hearing from people that are doing this now on the ground, your friends and colleagues from Navy EOD or you know, special warfare from wherever, are they that close to developing something?
So, you know, I don't have access to classified information. So all of, I would say anything I would reference would be open source, but it is widely believed that, you know, there's a few different things that go into creating a nuclear weapon that you can use. One is developing an implosion or a device that will create criticality or what's called supercriticality, right? So that's where you process uranium from its, really from how it was mined from the earth into what's called U-238 or U-239, which is highly enriched uranium. And then that highly enriched uranium has to be exposed to some type of neutron emitter to create a supercritical reaction or a nuclear explosion. So that's one component. Another component is a delivery system, you know, a tactical bullet, a missile, a ballistic missile, something that goes into outer space and comes back. So delivery, their delivery systems are also, or have been attacked, I should say, and their technology and their advancement in delivery systems is equally as important to disable as are their ability to enrich uranium and assemble the components that ultimately result in a nuclear weapon. So there's, you got to hit this thing from kind of 5.1 surround sound, if you will.
Yeah, no doubt. And we're speaking to Robert Pizzini. He's a former Navy EOD technician. He was the officer in charge of the nuclear response for the Navy EOD teams. He's also the best-selling author of Elevate Your Leadership. You can get that on Amazon, correct, Robert?
Yeah, it's available pretty much wherever books are sold, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, etc.
All right. And again, if you're in Virginia Beach this summer on vacation, you want to check out I Fly Virginia Beach Indoor Skydiving. I've been to this facility. It's just outstanding. So I highly recommend that for anybody headed to the Virginia Beach area for a vacation or a long weekend this summer.
Yeah, we are. The summer's here. We are rocking and rolling. And, you know, mom, dad, and the kids all day long. We're a family activity. And especially if the weather's not nice outside, we always have stable weather conditions and a nice breeze inside. So come see us at I Fly Virginia Beach for sure.
Absolutely. You got party rooms and everything, right?
Yeah, party rooms, birthday parties. We do corporate events. That's really, you know, one of the coolest things we've developed, and you're fully aware of. We have leadership and team development through some of our corporate offerings. And we have, of course, you know, centering around the flight experience. And Some leadership and team development experiences have you walk across hot coals. We have you fly in a flight chamber with a team of your people, team of your peers, and the net effect is the same. You face a challenge as a group, you overcome it, and you've really expanded your comfort zone. So our leadership and team development is really taking off, and so we have corporate offerings, we have private offerings, we have professional training. The whole range.
And if you're just down there with your friends on the weekend, stop in and see if you can get a space.
That's it, for sure, like you've done.
And absolutely. Robert Pizzini, I appreciate you talking with us today and your expertise in this matter.
Thanks, Rob. Have a great day.
You too, my friend. It's 425 here at WILK. Time for 2020 traffic and weather together. Here's the Storm Tracker 16 forecast from Chief Meteorologist Kurt Aaron. Tonight, foggy with some showers and downpours, a low of 68. There will be some dense fog in spots. Tomorrow, Thursday, partly sunny with some showers and storms in the afternoon, high of 85. Friday, mix of sun and clouds with an isolated shower, high of 82. Saturday, mostly sunny with an isolated storm, high 87. Sunday, mostly sunny with a hot and isolated storm, high of 91. So each day, weather goes up and up and up and up, but we knew this was coming. Welcome back to the Rob O'Donnell Show on WILK News Radio. It's the point of the show where we honor our heroes here at home throughout the Commonwealth who made the ultimate sacrifice on this day for us. On this day, June 18th, we have three members of Pennsylvania law enforcement. We're going to start off with Police Officer Stephen Edward Swaka, Philadelphia Police Department in 1983. He suffered a fatal heart attack following a struggle with a suspect in York Street and Sepvia Street, in which he and his partner suffered minor injuries. After arresting the suspect, the officer drove his partner to the police administration building to photograph his injuries. As he was waited outside, he began to suffer chest pains and drove himself to a local hospital where he passed from his heart attack. Patrol Officer Thomas Reese, Plymouth Borough Police Department, Pennsylvania, 1931. He was shot and killed with his own service weapon on Davenport Street near West Main Street while walking an assault suspect to the police station. The suspect had been involved with a fistfight with several people at a local restaurant on West Main Street. The suspect returned to the restaurant after retrieving a tire iron from his vehicle and started to pursue one of the men who was involved with the fight. Officer Reef was notified of the fight and caught the suspect on West Shawnee Avenue and Davenport Street. The officer Reef started to walk the suspect to the police station. A struggle ensued, and the suspect gained control of the officer Reef's service weapon and shot him in the head. Suspect was arrested shortly after. Chief of Police Joseph Wilson Norris, Juanita Borough Police Department in Pennsylvania, 1919. He succumbed to injuries sustained the night before when he attempted to arrest two men who were attempting to break into a home on Fifth Avenue. Chief Norris had just returned home for the night when he was called and alerted to the incident, which was occurring only one block away from his home. He located the suspects on the front porch of the home at 516 Fifth Avenue, discovered they were both drunk. He began to escort the two men to the borough jail. But as they approached the jail at the corner of 6th Avenue and 7th Street, the two men started to become belligerent. One of the men punched Chief Norris in the head, knocking him to the ground, causing a skull fracture when his head hit the curb. Both men were subdued by citizens and placed in jail. He died the following morning. The suspects, ages 25 and 26, were released after posting bail 10 days later. One who worked at the railroad was killed when he fell underneath a train. The other suspect was acquitted after his attorney convinced the jury that the other suspect caused the Constable Norris's death. And those are our three from here in Pennsylvania. I've been seeing a lot of stuff across the nation in regards to, you know, federal agents doing their enforcement jobs. And the public, both municipal and state level, that are looking to play the fence as far as their own law enforcement. And I get it. It's not local law enforcement's job to enforce immigration laws. And it shouldn't be. They're here to enforce the laws of the municipalities, the state, and the city, and the nation as a whole. That being said, if they happen to come across someone and determine that they are here illegally, not targeting them because they're here illegally, but come across them in the course of their duties for other instances. And our jails and our policies are just releasing them back into the public with a court date for whatever they were stopped for initially. It's just not the way to handle these things. And there needs to be concurrent systems to where we're going to come to some sort of we have to come to some sort of a stance for comprehensive immigration reform. You know, I think we're at that level yet. Are there millions here that came in under the last 4 years? What's interesting is we were getting 65,000 a month last year in the month of May. There was zero in the month of May of 2025. Zero came across the border. And those numbers are just staggering. 65,000 to zero in 1 year. So the job is being done at the border. Now the job needs to be done here. And in addition to that, come up with some sort of plan to deal with what they've been talking about for decades to deal with. What do we do with people who have been here over 5 years, illegal immigrants who have been here over 5 years, contributing to society, have no criminal record, are not a burden on our social systems? What's the plan to deal with them? Is it a fine? Is it some sort of plan to where they'll be giving permanent residency, but they should never become a citizen? I think that's definitely should be on the table. You're taking away the argument and incentive that they're looking for voters. Because if you come here illegally, you shouldn't ever be able to vote here. But there also needs to be a plan to deal with those people. And I hoped and wished that we'd start seeing something like that and not just focus on increasing the numbers to remove individuals. Now, listen, if they're targeting violent criminals who are illegal aliens and they're coming across people who just happen to be here, you're not walking away. You are going. And as per the numbers, 75% of those deported or those taken into custody have other criminal records. So it's a matter of time. And I think if municipalities, if states went to the administration and said, listen, if the governor of Pennsylvania and the governor of New York went to the Trump administration and said, listen, we will give you access and we will cooperate with our jails and our police departments if you agree not to target people simply here because they're here illegally. I think there's room for a talk there. Because if someone's arrested for something else, be it DUI, be it a simple assault, be it stealing from the store, and you're here illegally, well, I'm sorry, you don't deserve to be here anymore. And I think if municipalities, if states, if governors said, we will notify you, we will honor your detainers for those type of people, as long as you sign a memo of understanding that you will not be targeting people simply because they're here illegally. And put out the warning that if you are caught up and you're simply here illegally over 5 years and you did not pre-register, if you did not get on a list to when comprehensive immigration reform starts, to be part of that, you go back to the front of the line. But again, I think these things need to be happening holistically. And I've had this conversation today with someone high up from Department of Homeland Security. Because I've seen the issue that's happening now back when broken windows was a thing. I worked for Lieutenant Jack Maples. I worked for Bill Bratton, who were the founders of the broken windows theory in New York. Back when they were both transit police chief and head of intelligence for the transit police, Jack Maple. And then in the NYPD, the problem with broken windows is they got accustomed to numbers. When broken windows was a thing and we were grabbing all these people who had felony warrants, they were wanted for murder, they had guns, they had once you started taking all those people off the streets and they were going to jail for years, the higher ups still demanded those same numbers, those quotas. And yes, there are quotas. How come you're not making X amount of quality of life summonses or X amount of quality of life stops? How come you're not making X amount of warrant checks? Because once you get past the people who are criminals out there through these quality of life, then you're just dealing with the everyday citizens. And yes, they made an infraction. Yes, they made a mistake, but they don't have felony warrants. They're not criminals. They're not carrying guns. They don't have drugs. They're not wanted for assault or all these other things. And now every once in a while you come across them. But once you get the majority of them off the streets, you're dealing with everyday Americans, at which point you start to get pushback. Hey, now we're just being harassed. Now you're just dealing, you know, this is petty now. Because the whole premise of broken windows was to target the people wanted for bigger things, to stop the people who wanted to commit bigger crimes from jumping the turnstile, from creating graffiti and everything else. And I warn them, I don't want to see them make the same mistake now, where if you're going after complete numbers, you just want numbers, then you're targeting people who have been here who are not a threat to anyone. You're using resources that could be going after violent criminal illegal immigrants because they're processing the people you caught that weren't. So, you know, I told them that story, and hopefully someone listens. But I hear that, and I think there needs to be a balancing act. Now, I'm not saying we don't need to continue forward. Only 170,000 people have been sent out. There's lots more because millions came in. Like I said, in 1 month, May of 2024, it was 65,000 that month alone. But this anger, this manufactured crisis of Trump is just snatching people up and deporting them without due process. Look at the amount, the millions that past presidents have done the same for. It's manufactured. It's 4:45 here at WILK. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Rob O'Donnell Show on WILK News Radio. It's time for Today in History, because how do we know where we're going unless we remember where we've been? We got some doozies today. On this day, June 18th, the War of 1812 begins. June 18th, 1812, President James Madison signed a declaration of war against Great Britain. Starting the War of 1812, the conflict was driven by British interference with American shipping, imprisonment of U.S. sailors, and frontier tensions. Though controversial at the time, it marked a defining moment in U.S. sovereignty and nationalism. Sally Ride becomes the first American woman in space, June 18, 1983. Sally Ride made history aboard the Space Shuttle Challenger as the first American woman in space. Her six-day mission broke gender barriers and inspired generations of women in the STEM fields. Ride was just 32 years old at the time. Medal of Honor, first African-American recipient in the Vietnam War, June 18th, 1965. Milton L. Olive III, a 19-year-old Army paratrooper, heroically sacrificed his life by falling on a grenade to save fellow soldiers in Vietnam. He became the first African-American to receive the Medal of Honor for actions during that war. His bravery left a lasting legacy of courage and selflessness. The Treaty of Fort Laramie signed June 18, 1851. An early version of the Treaty of Fort Laramie was signed between the U.S. government and several Plains Indian tribes. Its goal was to ensure peace and safe passage for settlers heading west, but it was later broken repeatedly, highlighting a long and painful history of U.S. Native American relations. Also on this day, 1815, while not U.S. specific, the Battle of Waterloo, 1815. Napoleon's defeat had major global consequences and influenced U.S. foreign policy. In 1940, President Franklin D. Roosevelt gave one of his first chats, fireside chats, urging U.S. military preparedness as Europe was engulfed in World War II. And that's Today in History on this June 18th. It is 4:56 here at WILK. We'll be back. Oh, we're good. Okay. Let's see what we got here. I got what we're going to talk about. Remember last week, Jake, you probably remember it. You know, I was warning people that they were going to have these stings across the counties, and they were going to have massive amounts of state troopers and local police doing DUIs and full suppressions, you know.
I do remember
coverage.
That now.
Well, we have the statistics now. The statistics for that, and we warned you. They warned you. They publicized it. It was out there. Well, the Pennsylvania State Police at Wilkes-Barre, Troop P, released the statistics from Operation Nighthawk, a drunk driving enforcement initiative conducted Friday, June 13th and Saturday, June 14th. 725 motorists were contacted. That means they had contacts with them, pulled over or stopped or some sort of intervening. Driving under the influence arrests, 82. Drug arrests, 24. Seatbelt citations, 37. Driving under a suspended license, 27. Driving under suspension DUI-related, 13. They gave out 293 traffic citations, 471 warnings, 9 misdemeanor arrests, and 1 felony arrest. They also served 3 warrants. So 3 people hit warrants, positive for warrants. More than 60 troopers, multiple law enforcement officers participated in Operation Nighthawk in Luzerne, Lackawanna, and Monroe counties. Now, those numbers are staggering. And again, the 9 misdemeanor arrests and 1 felony arrest were for other than DUI. They had 82 DUI arrests, 24 drug arrests, 9 felony misdemeanor arrests and 1 felony arrest and 3 warrants. It just goes to show, and there was about 60 troopers and officers that partake in this, 725 contacts. And if you say, well, you know, the police are just mean out there, just looking to write tickets. Well, they gave out 293 traffic citations, but they gave out 471 warnings. So they were more lenient than they were banging you over the head with a citation. But when it comes to DUI, it's zero tolerance. When it comes to drug arrests, it's zero tolerance. When it comes to misdemeanors and felonies or warrants, there's not much they could do. But it just goes to show, I talked about this. It was in the newspaper. It was on the TV news. Doesn't seem to matter. 725 contacts during this event. 82 DUI arrests. And the reason I stress that is because your kids are out driving on these roads. Your husbands, your wives, your grandparents, your parents. School kids going back and forth to school. Now, I get it. This was Friday, Saturday. But with all the warning that this was taking place, with everybody, even the law enforcement saying, hey, we're doing this. Still happening. Still that danger out there. 82 DUI arrests. That could have been tragic for any one of those situations. So please, please, if you're planning on drinking, if you go somewhere and didn't plan on drinking and you have your vehicle there, there are always options. Don't do it. I only had a few. I can make it home. I only live a couple of miles. Oh, it's all rural roads. Yeah, our rural roads aren't the easiest to drive sometimes. Use your head. It's 5 o'clock.